sweat the technique. All teams covered. No talking points necessary. You're back with the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
No blankers, had to take care of a fevered child. Let's go straight out to the HRMP guest line. B-Mac filling in for the moment for blankers. Let's go straight out to the HRMP guest line, being joined by Hacksaw Dan Duggan, beat reporter for the New York Football Giants with The Athletic. Thanks for taking a few minutes this afternoon, Dan, and hanging out with us. Mike Kafka is going to interview with the Houston Texans in person tomorrow, one of two in-person interviews the Texans have planned tomorrow. It'll be the second time he interviews with the Houston Texans. First and foremost, how serious of a candidate do you think Kafka is for the Texans?
Well, I mean, he's made it to like round two of the process, right? So you probably know better than me, but usually if you pass through that Zoom stage in person, you're pretty serious. But I know I haven't really followed too closely how many people the Texans have brought in, but usually you kind of start, you know, casting a wide net and then you narrow it down. You're not going to bring a million people into town. So I would think you've got to be a pretty serious candidate if you've gotten to this stage of the process.
Dan, obviously with Brian Daboll there, a lot of credit to the Giants' offensive success going up from, I believe, second worst in the league to 18th last year was given to him. But obviously for Texans fan hoping to have an offense improvement, if they do hire Mike Kafka, how much of the offense's turnaround do you give credit to Kafka versus Daboll in this situation?
Yeah, I mean, it's always hard to kind of slice that pie. I mean, I will say he was the offensive coordinator. It wasn't one of these deals where you had the title, but Daboll ran the show. I mean, Daboll's whole point was when he got hired, he wanted to be the CEO and run the entire operation. So now, that being said, when he first came in, I mean, he brought his offense from Buffalo, and then he hires Kafka, and obviously he was smart enough to say, well, he probably learned a few things from Andy Reid. So they melded some of their things together. I think you saw elements from both. But once the season started, I mean, Kafka was the play caller. Like, it wasn't like on Sundays that Daboll was, you know, in his ear saying, run this, run that. I mean, it was Kafka's show. Obviously, Dable's going to have, you know, input on the game plan as the week progresses, but, you know, Kafka was the guy. He was the one calling the plays. You see them run the Statue of Liberty down in the red zone in the first playoff game against Minnesota. That's Kafka making that call. So he was more hands-on than some cases where you have an offensive head coach who's calling plays and the OC is kind of like a quality control type guy. I mean, he was the offensive coordinator, but obviously, you know, with a heavy influence from Daboll.
Being joined on the HRMP guest line by Dan Duggan, covers the New York Giants for the Athletics. For the Athletic. Dan, a lot of people, you know, I posted about this earlier with Kafka news coming down that, like, I think that Kafka's a serious candidate for all the things that you just said. You know, if you're getting a second interview with the team, they're serious. They're serious about you. You got a chance to land the job. You have a chance to impress. He's going to be in person. So that matters, I think, a little bit, too. And I think a lot of Texans fans are enamored with DeMeco Ryans, rightfully so, former player, former captain for the team, one of the best players in Houston Texans franchise history. So there's a lot of, you know, allure there from the fan base to DeMeco Ryans, and they kind of poo-poo on Kafka a little bit. 18th offense in the NFL, which I don't think is entirely fair. Like B-Mac just said a moment ago, you go from 31st in the NFL in offense to 18th in offense when really your only skill position player that is for sure a top half of the NFL player relative to the position is probably Saquon Barkley. Saquon Barkley's top half of the NFL at the running back position. None of the receivers are. Daniel Jones is questionable. Management didn't want to give Daniel Jones the fifth-year option. I think it's a pretty good job what he did to get that Giants offense to 18th in the NFL.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I don't know that you can judge them just based on raw numbers because, yeah, like you said, they just didn't have a ton of firepower on offense, I think. If you want to look at an area where you can really trace, I really think his influence probably even as much as Brian Daboll's is their red zone offense. They were one of the top red zone offenses in the league this year, and that's coming from being 32nd and 31st the last 2 years. So I think a lot of that type of execution down there is based on scheme. And again, you know, he's coming from Kansas City where Andy Reid's as creative as any coach in the business, and you could definitely see plays that they ran that were imported directly from Kansas City. So I think that, like, looking just at his, you know, production as far as points per game, that's probably a little unfair. I will say, though, obviously you're not interviewing to be the OC. Mm-hmm. If you're skeptical, I think it's really just he's pretty green. I mean, he's only been a coordinator for 1 year in the NFL. He's only been in coaching for about 5 or 6 years. So obviously, he bounced around the league as a backup quarterback for a number of years. So that would be the thing that I think he would have to overcome, because even a guy like DeMeco Ryans, I mean, he's been a coordinator, you know, for a top team for a number of years, whereas with Kafka, he's young, hasn't done it for too long. At the same time, The trend is to hire these young up-and-coming offensive coaches, so if you don't get them this cycle, you might kind of miss your chance on a rising star.
Dan, what would you say? I think in sports media and sports fans are alike in this. We sometimes suffer from recency bias, and the most recent result we saw from the Giants was only scoring 7 points at the Eagles last weekend. What would you say to fans who would look at the Giants offense with concern of only scoring 7 points in last week's game?
Yeah, I mean, that's tough. I remember when they hired Pat Shurmur as head coach a couple of years back. It was like 3 head coaches ago, so excuse me if I remember what year that was, 2018. And everyone knew he was going to get the job, and then Minnesota went into Philly and basically had the same exact result. Got destroyed. So it was a little wind out of the sails, when he's getting introduced like the next day, coming off, getting absolutely destroyed in a big playoff game. But, I mean, I think obviously you have to take a step back, look at the big picture. If they do hire him and you want to feel a little better, turn on the tape from the week before against Minnesota, where the offense was, really effective, looked really good. And again, I think so much of their success this year was scheme and coaching, because again, they just did not have a lot of talent. But so when you have guys like Darius Slayton and Isaiah Hodgins and Richie James, stop me if you've heard of any of these guys, they're tearing up an NFL defense in a playoff game. I think a lot of that has to go to coaching. So, I mean, I think, yes, they ran into a buzzsaw against Philly. They were totally outclassed in terms of talent. But I wouldn't put that, that wouldn't make me really nervous coaching-wise, because, again, I mean, they're just overmatched in that game.
A lot of people in Houston are wondering, Dan, if you go offense, just because of what the candidates are, and a lot of people here feel like the final four are D'Amico Ryans, Jonathan Gannon, the two defensive guys, and then Kafka and Steichen. I've been going back and forth on which one of the two is a better candidate. I think you bring up a good point, too. The previous question that I asked you, that you're not hiring him to be the OC. You're hiring him to be the offensive coordinator. And look, he might be part of game planning. Maybe he even calls plays on Sunday. But if he does that, he's also adding the element that he's overseeing the entire operation. You got to have leadership there. People like to use the phrase leader of men. You got to run the whole program. What have you seen from Kafka that gives off those leadership attributes just in the short time that he's been there in New York?
I mean, honestly, that would be a question for me. I mean, obviously made it to the second round, so he did a good job in that first interview, but he is not a big presence. Like, he doesn't come in and kind of command the room, at least in my experience, media-wise. I'll tell a funny story that I said in another interview. I was doing an Indianapolis interview because he's getting around.
Yeah.
Another outlet up here just wrote a feature about him. They spoke to his mother, and even his mother said he's boring. So if mom is going on the record saying her son is boring, I think it's pretty safe to say he's not the most vivacious guy, and that's fine. Like, there's a million different personalities that work, but he's not a guy who is going to come in and have people ready to run through the wall in an introductory press conference and he gets the job. I wouldn't think, unless he flips the switch. He's just a very understated, kind of cerebral guy. I mean, he's obviously very smart, Northwestern guy, and the way he coaches football, you can see he's very good at scheming. And players like him, don't get me wrong. It's not like he's has a bad personality. He's just a little bit more reserved. And if you pull up any of his press conferences this year, it was like pulling teeth to try and get him to say anything. He's just not that type of guy. And again, that's fine, but I don't know how that translates. The offensive players obviously responded to him just fine this year. But it's different, from coaching one side of the ball and a lot of game plan stuff to really being the face of a franchise and having to run so many other elements beyond just what the plays you're going to call on Sunday. I don't know. I mean, obviously, any of these guys would be a first-time head coach. You don't know how any of them respond to it, but that would certainly be a fair question for a guy like him.
Having watched the offense that he called this year in New York, obviously he spent this year under Brian Daboll, the previous, I guess, 5-6 seasons under Andy Reid, if he gets this head coaching job or any of the head coaching jobs and is putting in his own offense, do you expect it to mirror more of what we see from the Andy Reid offense or the Brian Daboll offense?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's a good question. It's impossible to know. I would assume it would probably lean more Kansas City because that's, really where he kind of grew up, and he was, even with Reid, I believe he's back with him in Philly. But I think this is a good experience for him to come kind of here, spread his wings, because really the reason he left Kansas City to come here was basically to put himself in this type of position. There's always a ceiling in Kansas City because, we see with Eric Bieniemy, if you're on the offensive side of the ball, well, everyone knows Andy Reid's calling the plays, Andy Reid's running the show. He came to New York. He got the call plays, much more of an influence on the offense, and I think it'll help him that he can pull from Brian Daboll. I think it's good for these coaches to have been on different branches, or to branch out a little bit so they can pull from different ideas, not just football-wise, but how Andy might have handled some situations, how Brian Daboll handled situations. So I think that stuff's all really good. I mean, as far as his offense, yeah, I mean, that's obviously a question I'm sure they've already talked about in the first interview, I'm sure, but I would think it would probably be, a little more skewed towards Kansas City, but he'd be dumb if he didn't borrow some ideas when you learn from Brian Daboll, who obviously is a very good offensive mind.
Yeah. And, I mean, who you have at quarterback matters too, right? I mean, you have to bring the best out of who you have at the quarterback position. If you have a Pat Mahomes, that brings into play some things. If you have somebody with the athleticism of Daniel Jones, it brings into play certain things as well. Hacksaw Dan Duggan, the New York Giants beat reporter for The Athletic. Dan, I'm curious. The Giants are one of the teams in the NFL that going into this offseason, I'm fascinated with what they do. You know, even being here in Houston, but the contract situation of Daniel Jones, Saquon Barkley, I'm sure there's more that I'm not even thinking about. How do you think the Giants handle their quarterback position and their running back position going into the offseason?
Yeah, no, if you're intrigued by it, imagine being in my shoes and something. I'm going to be living and breathing this in the next couple of months. Yes, we got our first chance to talk to GM Joe Shane yesterday after the season ended, and he all but said Daniel Jones would be back. Now, I mean, there's some business to be worked out there, whether it's on the franchise tag. I'm sure they'd prefer it to be a longer-term deal so they don't tie up that much of the cap this year. But so he definitely proved enough that they feel comfortable bringing him back, making that type of commitment, which it says something because, you know, they declined the fifth-year option when they came in. So he had a really make-or-break season, and he got it done. So he'll be back. Saquon is the one that's very interesting because they talked to him at the midseason bye week. And it seemed like from afar, like, all right, they're talking, that's a good sign, and maybe they'll just kind of pick that up when the season ends and get something done. But Joe Shane said yesterday they weren't even really close during the bye week. It feels like they have a hard number, whatever that may be, like say it's $12 million a year. And if Saquon isn't willing to come down to that number, where, you know, maybe he's looking more like 14, 15, I don't know that they get a deal done. So, you know, you're only talking a couple million dollars per year. But again, if Shane is really this dug in, it feels like this could get a little dicey, especially if that uses a tag on Daniel Jones. Then I really think it's hard to see them bringing Saquon back because, you know, if he tests the market, there's some team out there that's going to have a boatload of cap space you'd think would blow a guy like him away. So I don't know. That one's really interesting. I think Jones is not too intriguing just because I think, you know, the minds have been made up to bring him back one way or the other. Saquon is kind of a much bigger variable.
The tag on Jones would be fascinating because you're playing Daniel Jones now, somebody you didn't give a fifth-year option to, top five money. Like, that would be wild to me. And then the Saquon Barkley thing's interesting, too, because if you don't believe in, like, drafting running backs in the first round, why do you pay a running back? But, Dan, great stuff as always. We appreciate you coming on, sharing some insight on Kafka. And I'll be watching that Giants situation very closely. Have a good rest of your afternoon. Hope we catch up again in the future.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
Hacksaw Dan Duggan, the Giants beat reporter for the Athletic. Brought up some concerns there for Kafka. He also said some things that intrigued me. In fact, Kafka just jumped Shane Steichen on my list. I'll tell you why. Also, the Dallas Cowboys are getting crushed for this story that they posted about Dak Prescott. I might be in the minority here. I love it. I'll tell you what we mean next. Killer Bees, ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
This is Ed Tuttle Jones, and you're listening to ESPN 97.5.
Independent thinking, unrestricted opinions. You're tuned in to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Blanker's out tending to a fevered daughter. BMAC filling in. Big shoes to fill, literally. But BMAC doing an admirable job. Tom from Kingwood. BMAC, I'm going to need some help kind of translating this text. I really don't know what it means. Tom from Kingwood, your list of defensive coaches left off, Dan Quinn, John Fox, Tony Dungy, Mike Tomlin, and Mike Vrabel. What's he talking about?
Oh, we were talking about, I guess, coaches that got to the Super Bowl that were defensive-minded coaches, but Dan Quinn lost, John Fox lost.
Yeah, I thought we were talking about Super Bowl-winning coaches like in the last decade. Because Dan Quinn didn't, John Fox didn't, Tony Dungy didn't, Mike Tomlin didn't, and Mike Vrabel didn't.
Yeah,
like,
so.
You might need to help me out there a little bit, Tom from Kingwood. But Tom from Kingwood also says, "What would your worries about D'Amico be calmed if he convinced Gary Kubiak to be his offensive coordinator?" Absolutely.
But now, that doesn't address, though, the issue of the revolving door. Because
I think it does.
Well, can we guarantee health and the fact that Kubiak would be here long term? I don't think we can.
Maybe in the pipe dream that I'm having. Because
sure,
I think
sure.
It is. Because Kubiak has also been rumored that he doesn't want to come back, that he's going to stay retired. He might do like an advisory role, a consultant role. But there's thoughts out there that he has zero interest being day-to-day coordinator of an NFL football team.
And that's
so
the reason
I don't think
that
feasible.
I don't think it would change
sure.
much. In the
that's
short
true.
Term, it'd be great. I'm all for it. I mean, the D'Amico Gary Kubiak combination mm-hmm. would be a dream team, in my opinion, but I would still have the same concerns with the revolving door because
sure.
with his health and history of leaving jobs after a few years for whatever reason he has, whether it be health or family or whatever it is, I just don't expect him to be here for more than 2-3 years.
That's what the Vero was asking me on the Twitch channel, twitch.tv/ESPN97.5. Like, if D'Amico does hit on the OC in his first – like, if D'Amico's the head coach, he hits on the OC – okay, if he makes a really young quarterback look really good, a rookie quarterback look good, he's probably gone in 2 years. So you have 2 years of that. So now you need to hit every single time to continue that level of success, and I think that's very challenging for a defensive coordinator.
I will say, though, to maybe kind of spin a silver lining to that, if the first OC you have under D'Amico, if he makes the right hire, and let's say in this scenario he has Bryce Young,
mm-hmm.
first year or two, he makes Bryce Young look great, and he translates the OC, that is, translates that into a head coaching gig. Well, the next bright mind that has visions of moving up the coaching ladder would look at this situation as a chance to possibly stake his name to a hot young quarterback and then also get a head coaching gig. So I think, yes, you would have to change over to a different coach, but it would be an attractive job where you could attract the top young minds.
Sure. Yeah, I think, and look, that's possible. I just feel like it's less likely to be able to hit on that OC every 3 to 4 years. And look, maybe you're firing him in 2 years. He's not very good. That also comes into play. Whereas you look at Kansas City, never have to worry about that. Cincinnati, never have to worry about that. Vera says you need a vet OC. Gannon's rumored to bring in Frank Reich. I have zero interest in that. I have zero interest in Frank Reich as the offensive coordinator for the Houston Texans. One thing I'm going to say here, BMAC, one thing that I'm flipping, because Kafka and Steichen have been very... I've went back and forth on them 100 times. Like, one day I like Steichen more, one day I like Kafka more. I think what puts me over the edge when it comes to Kafka over Steichen is the fact that Steichen had a lot to work with. Like, I think Jalen Hurts, and once upon a time I didn't think this, I think this now, Jalen Hurts is really stinking good.
And before that, Justin Herbert, obviously.
And Justin Herbert, obviously, too, back when he was the OC for the Chargers, interim OC for a year, and then the full OC for Herbert's rookie season. Whereas Kafka had Daniel Jones. Like, whenever we went into the season, we looked at Daniel Jones as a bottom third of the NFL quarterback. And now we're talking about him potentially getting a franchise tag. Like, he went from being somebody, the team was zero, had zero interest in picking up his fifth-year option, was a bottom third of the NFL quarterback, and there is a possibility. Look, I think he's ultimately going to stay with the Giants. I think he'll sign a contract. But if he doesn't sign the contract, he's going to be franchise tagged and make, on average this year, the average of the top 5 salaries in football. And Kafka brought that out of Daniel Jones. That's a huge feather in Kafka's cap.
Go ahead, sorry.
And then one other thing, too, is just the amount of people that Kafka has worked with. Like, Kafka played in the NFL for a long time and had a bunch of different stops. Philly, New England, Jacksonville, Tampa, Minnesota, Tennessee, Cincinnati. As a coach, it was all Andy Reid. But he's been exposed and around to a lot of different football minds. Where if you look at Steichen, didn't have a career as a player, started off as, you know, a college assistant, as most of them do, but then 1 year with the Browns, the quality control coach, then he was with the Chargers up until the Philadelphia stint. So he hasn't been exposed and around as many football minds. So that gives Kafka the slight edge. If the Texans go offense, I prefer Kafka over Steichen.
I think that makes a lot of sense because you and I were both on the train to hire Ben Johnson before he took his name out of consideration for not just the Texans but all teams.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the talking points and things that we said about Ben Johnson as positives to hire him was also kind of the same thing what you just said for Mike Kafka, where he took Daniel Jones, someone that people casted off as nothing, and turned him into at least a feasible quarterback. Same thing we saw Ben Johnson doing year one with the Lions, taking Jared Goff, someone who kind of been written off as not being able to do anything outside of Sean McVay, and then at least in the home games, because the road games are a little questionable for Jared Goff, but at least in the home games, Jared Goff had a great season and obviously had the Lions with a winning record. So I think there's a lot of similarities in what we liked in Ben Johnson that you could apply to Mike Kafka.
I like when dudes, and the biggest concern is Kafka's working with Daboll, so it's hard to know the genius in that room. But I like it when coaches bring the most out of bad players, because now it's not the player that's making the coach look good.
Right.
Like Kansas City offensive coordinator, Eric Bieniemy. Like, Eric Bieniemy intrigues me as a head coach.
It's Patrick Mahomes.
It's Andy Reid's show. It's Pat Mahomes' show. Whenever I look at the Lions, well, I know it's Benny Johnson's show. When I look at the Eagles, I don't know. Like, how much is it Steichen? How much is it Sirianni? How much is it the players? Because I think that they have a better offensive roster. The Giants, you still have those questions with Kafka, but at least it's not the players. I know it's not the players.
And that was one of the reasons that when we had Hacksaw Dan Duggan on, I asked him about, you know, who he gave the credit to, you know, Kafka or Daboll. And he didn't fully go out and give credit to one over the other. But he did point out to say that this wasn't some sort of situation where it was an offensive coordinator kind of, you know, wink and nod, but it's really Brian Daboll, is really the head coach doing everything. He said this guy was the play caller, and if he wasn't a good play caller, we wouldn't have seen those improvements out of the Giants' offense.
713-780-ESPN, the HRMP listener line, 713-780-3776. Let's go out to the HRMP listener line. General Ben is on the line. Ben, you're in the hive with the Killer Bees. What's up, Jen? What's up, Ben?
Hey, thank you for that compliment with General Ben. My question is, you said Kubiak, right, and DeVito. Yeah. Wouldn't it make more sense if Kubiak does come, but he brings his son along with him, and then whenever Kubiak's ready to, you know, leave in a year or two, he just hands it off to his son? Like, his son probably knows a lot about the system as well. Same thing with Kyle Shanahan. He learned under Kubiak. Like, wouldn't he do the same with his son?
I think it's a pipe dream. Like, I really do, because of the reports we heard that Kubiak's not interested in an everyday role. Now, I would love that. I would love that, because I think that you are, to an extent, not completely, to B-Mac's point, because, you know, he could retire in 2 years. Maybe he could retire in five. And this, I don't think, is all that realistic. But I think that your scenario, Ben, is a great one. And it might not even need Gary to happen. Like, it might be baby Kubiak that is the offensive coordinator for
with
DeVito.
With dad
Ryan.
As the...
He has dinner with him at night.
Well,
you know?
maybe like a special consultant or special. I mean, you can have a situation where Gary has a role, a job in the organization as some sort of offensive consultant. Doesn't have to maybe be in the building every day, so he's not having to fully commit like he would if he was the OC. But he's there to assist his son and maybe smooth the transition. I think that if you want to go that route, I think that could be something that works more so than the, like you said, pipe dream of actually hiring Gary Kubiak. I don't think that's going to happen.
And there's been some thought and some rumors that, like, the Jets were interested in Gary Kubiak as kind of that offensive advisor.
I just don't think he's going to do it.
I think he should be the Dan Reeves of the Houston Texans.
Could
and
be.
You're probably wondering, what do you mean by that? Remember whenever the Houston Texans, what was it, like, probably year three of the organization, or was it from
I
the start?
I thought it was when they made the eventual transition from the first coaching staff to Kubiak.
Yeah, Reeves was the bridge.
He was never
the head coach,
right.
But he was like the advisory council for Bob McNair. That should be Gary Kubiak for Cal McNair. Gary Kubiak should have a role in this organization. Is it a pipe dream for him to be the OC of DeMeco Ryans? Yeah, I that would be awesome. That would be great. I don't think it's likely. I think that Kubiak should be involved in the coaching cycle. I think he should be involved in the decision. I think he should be the right-hand man of Cal McNair. And if they do go DeMeco and DeMeco brings in baby Kubiak as the offensive coordinator, I want Gary involved as much as Gary's willing to be involved.
I mean, why wouldn't you want, at the very least, Gary involved in the hiring process of the offensive staff?
Sure.
At the very least.
At the very least. Like, maybe he's not hiring the head coach.
Right.
But, hey, DeMeco
brings him in as a consultant and has him kind of give his input on the offensive staff to help best put in that style of offense.
Yeah, maybe that happened. I think that's the best case for DeMeco Ryans from an offensive point of view. 713-780-ESPN. We'll get to the Cowboys stuff a little bit later. Howard Balzer, the wizard of the NFL. Got a lot of things to get to with the wizard. It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
To the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
No Blankers today. He's taking care of a sick daughter. All is well, but she has a fever. Let's go straight out to the HRMP guest line, being joined now by the wizard of the NFL, Howard Balzer. Howard, a fun weekend this past weekend, the divisional round of the NFL playoffs. We now have our final four, if you will. What were some of your big takeaways, your biggest takeaways from the divisional round with four teams punching their ticket into the conference championship games?
I guess the two really at the top of the list are the way the Eagles were able to just dominate the Giants. I thought that the Giants would put up a little bit better fight, but the Eagles came loaded, had all their main guys back, and they just showed the same team pretty much that had gone through the entire schedule before they had the injury to Jalen Hurts and Lane Johnson at right tackle, and they just came out and just exerted their will on the Giants. And is a team that's been pretty healthy all season, had those little bumps in the road there. Now they've gotten back healthy again. And boy, this game Sunday, I think should be unbelievable with them and the 49ers. And the other one is flipping to the AFC. It's just the way the Bengals were able to do what they did. They did a great job of preparing, especially on that offensive line where they had all the changes that could have really hurt them. And they just came out and said, hey, here's the way we're going to do it, and we're going to go against a defense that we feel we match up well against. But the other part of it is that I think a lot of people for two seasons now have been sleeping on the Bengals' defense. And it was the defense really, you know, basically kept them in the game last year in the Super Bowl against the Rams, except for the final drive, of course. But they've still done an excellent, excellent job. And it's interesting, you never hear their coordinator's name mentioned for any of these coaching jobs, Lou Anarumo, or Anarumo, however he pronounces his darn name, but you never hear his name mentioned. But he's done a great job with that team, and to go out there and, you know, hold the Bills to 10 points, that was pretty impressive.
Sticking with the Bengals, Howard, I mean, obviously what we saw from Joe Burrow was amazing. And in that game, it seemed like Josh Allen maybe took a little bit of a step back. Obviously, Stephon Diggs wasn't too happy and has made it vocally well known. Do you think at this point Burrow has vaulted himself to maybe the second best quarterback in the league behind Patrick Mahomes?
He very well might be, and I think he's been in that conversation all along. And he did it last year, so I was just alluding to just what they were able to do on offense, even though he was like a human punching bag back there with all the times he was sacked, not only in the regular season but in the playoffs, and he just still came back for more. But obviously he has great talent around him on that offense. That certainly helps. And when you look at the Bills, really, I mean, Josh Allen's a hell of a quarterback. It's very close between those guys. But, you know, just compare that skilled talent that the Bengals have to the Bills, and they're better at basically every position, especially at running back. You know, Jamar Chase, T. Higgins, you know, Stephon Diggs, the heck of a receiver. But then after that, I mean, the Bengals just dominate in those positions. And that's a big, big part, obviously, of how good Burrow is and how good this team has been now for two complete seasons.
Howard Balzer joining us on the HRMP guest line, wizard of the NFL. And Howard, maybe I'm a fool. It wouldn't be the first time I've been called that. It wouldn't be the last time I'll be called that. I just don't – I still don't believe in Brock Purdy. Is that foolish of me?
No, I don't think it's necessarily foolish. I think probably a lot of people don't, because they say, how could this be happening? But he is a product of that team. And I hate to say that, oh, he's a great game manager and that, you know, all those things, but he's obviously very well coached. He obviously has, you know, I don't know if he has blood in his veins, but whatever it is, it's pretty incredible to be doing all these things as a rookie and as the last pick in the draft. But again, he's coached into just saying, hey, just be calm out there. And he is. His personality is like that. And with all that talent they have, led by a great offensive line. I mean, look at the teams that are playing now. For the most part, it's teams with offensive lines. And teams that don't win a lot of times are banged up there or just aren't very good. But with the offensive line and all that offensive talent and that great defense, and in the first half, they struggled a little bit. They had some third and longs. But he's coached to say, okay, don't do anything crazy on third and long. You don't have to make a bad decision. You don't have to force a ball somewhere. There's no crime in punting, because we'll stop them and we'll get the ball back and then be able to get the ball to Christian McCaffrey and Elijah Mitchell and George Kittle and Brandon Ayuk and Debo Samuel. I mean, that's a heck of an offense. And so, I mean, it is impressive that he's doing this as a rookie, but at this point, he's probably looking at it, hey, I played all these games. I'm not a rookie anymore. I played in some of the biggest games there can be, and it hasn't blinked. So, you know, until he proves otherwise, I'm just going to say that he's just doing what he's coached to do within this offense, and he does it obviously very well.
Howard, on the other side of that game, the other quarterback on the field, Dak Prescott, has obviously caught a lot of heat. Another game with multiple turnovers. He's had that quite a few times this season. I think some people are even wondering at this point, not only is Mike McCarthy safe, but is Dak Prescott a quarterback capable of getting the Cowboys to an NFC title game or even to a Super Bowl? Where do you stand right now with Dak Prescott? Obviously, huge contract, but do the Cowboys have to make some sort of decision about how to change maybe a decision on how to build around Dak to get to the next level?
Well, yeah, I think like you pointed out, building around him was certainly key. And overlooking this, I remember a couple of years, it might have been last year, maybe it was the year before, when the Packers lost a key playoff game, when it was that controversial year where they got to the 8-yard line or whatever it was and had a first and goal and never ran the ball. And then Rodgers wanted to go for it. They went for the field goal. But the reality was everyone forgot that they were playing that second half without their best running back, Aaron Jones. He had gone out. It was either right before halftime or right after halftime. And that changed their strategy in terms of what they could do on offense. I guarantee you, had Aaron Jones been out there, they would have run the ball, if not on first down, maybe on second down just to get closer. And so hardly anybody's talking about the loss of Tony Pollard. You know, everyone just always wants to blame the quarterback. Oh, it's the quarterback. And yeah, he had a couple he'd like to take back, but bottom line is they were still in the game, still had an opportunity, but Pollard left. You know, Pollard left with an injury, and that was a huge loss for that offense. And those things matter. I know a lot of people respond when I bring up injuries wherever, whatever venue I'm on, radio, writing, whatever it is. Oh, those are excuses. No, they're not excuses. When you don't have your best players there, and especially when it happens during a game, that impacts what you're able to do. Now, I'm not saying if they had Pollard, they would have won, but they were right there. I mean, they were right there within shouting distance of the 49ers, and they just weren't able to make the play when they needed to, again, going against one of the best defenses in football. I think sometimes it's kind of forgotten there's another team out there on the other side, and everyone thinks, our team or the team you're looking at, you know, just go out there and do this and do that. Well, they're trying to do that, but sometimes the other team has an awful lot to say about that.
Yeah. How are we? We're dissecting and breaking down everything imaginable when it comes to hiring a head coach. Texans find themselves in this position yet again, third time in 3 years. And we were having the conversation a little bit earlier about, you know, an offensive-minded head coach, defensive-minded head coach. You look at the last 10 years of Super Bowl winners, they're usually offensive-minded. You look to the final four of the teams that are going to represent each conference, respectively, their conference championship game, all offensive minds. The Elite Eight were all offensive minds, with the exception of Sean McDermott in Buffalo. Is the old adage that defense wins championships, can you still say that now in 2022 going into the 2023 season?
Well, I think you can definitely say that defenses certainly contribute mightily to championships. There's no question about it. But you still have to have an offense that scores points. I think there's a lot of factors involved in those points you just made in terms of why that's happening. And by the way, I went back and looked at 10 years of head coaching changes. Believe it or not, in the last 10 years, not counting this year, there have been 69 head coaches hired in the NFL.
Nice.
69 in 10 years. Last five, it's been 37. And the one consistency is two out of every three of those hires are guys that are offense-oriented. And here's why I think it happens. Certainly, it gives you a leg up because offense, like I said, you better be able to score points and you better be able to develop a quarterback. But here's the thing about it. It's not to say that defensive coaches aren't good coaches, but what often happens is you hire a defensive coach, the hardest thing he has to do then is to hire his offensive coordinator and his quarterback's coach, because that goes a tremendous way in terms of developing that quarterback. But then what happens if you're successful? The offensive coordinator leaves to go somewhere else because another team is going to hire him, and then all of a sudden you're sitting there with a successful offense but without a coordinator and have to hire someone new. If you're the head coach and it's your offense that you've implemented and then brought along the coordinators, whoever they are, sometimes in name only, like Doug Peterson and Matt Nagy in Kansas City, the offense still continues on with continuity because it's the head coach's offense. And I think that's a big reason why we have seen this trend. And then you point out how those are the teams that win, and a lot of times it is because of that continuity. I mean, look at the 49ers and Kyle Shanahan. It's like they can plug in almost any quarterback. They can plug in almost any running back, and they're going to be good, very good, because of the system that is there, and it's the same system that you're just refining year after year. Anytime you have to change, well, you can take some steps back, and that's a big part of the success these teams have had. And Kansas City's a perfect example, as I was just mentioning with Andy Reid. Obviously, Patrick Mahomes is a generational talent. But they've done it this year. I actually voted for Andy Reid. I'm probably the only one. I actually voted for Andy Reid as coach of the year. Here was a team that everyone was expecting to take a step back. Oh, they lost Tyreek Hill. And all they did was regroup with whatever group they had, and they went out there and still won 14 games. It's hard to do that as a head coach in this league when everyone's gunning for you. But there it is. There's that continuity of that system,
yep,
which breeds success. It's hard to be successful, but once you have it, you want to be able to continue it, and that's what offensive head coaches are able to do over the long term.
Yeah, it's hard to find that head coach quarterback pairing, but it's almost like if you have it, you're going to be a Super Bowl contender for a decade. Like, I think that you have to be searching for it all the time. Howard, great stuff as always. Enjoy the conference championship games this weekend.
Thanks. You too. Take care. I always enjoy coming on with you.
We know you do. Howard Balzer, the wizard of the NFL. Always great to have the wizard on with the Killer Bees. All right, the Astros are in the news. Maybe some Yuli Gurriel, some good news. Maybe one last Hail Mary for Yuli Gurriel to be an Astro. Also, a new name has emerged as a possibility for the Houston Astros as the general manager, the former Astro, the good-looking catcher, Brad Ausmus. Are the Astros for real? It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
ESPN 97.5. Your team's our priority. Join the conversation with the Killer Bees. Now coming to you live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Maybe one last Hail Mary for Yuli Gurriel to remain a Houston Astro. Remember Jeff Bagwell, who is the advocate for the Houston Astros?
GM Jeff Bagwell?
No, do not say GM. That's a pet peeve of mine. It is a pet peeve of mine when people call Jeff Bagwell the general manager of the Astros. Jeff Bagwell does not want to work that hard. Jeff Bagwell does not want to crunch the WOBA of double-A prospects.
Who was the one front office guy speaking at FanFest?
He's the advocate.
There you go.
He's the advocate. Paul Heyman. Yeah, he's the Paul Heyman for the Houston Astros. He's the advocate for the tribal chief, the head of the table, Jim Crane.
Jim Crane's the tribal chief in this
Jim
scenario?
Crane is the tribal chief. He's the undisputed champion, the undisputed reigning.
Should we be acknowledging Jim Crane on a daily basis? Is that how we should start the show?
He probably should, yeah.
I don't have a problem
with
that.
Jeff Bagwell is the wise man. He's the advocate. He is the he's the legal counsel for the Houston Astros. But Jeff Bagwell said that they're going to continue to monitor the Yuli Gurriel situation. I've been a proponent of bringing in one more utility guy and start the year with David Hensley out in Sugarland because injuries are going to happen. It's inevitable. Show me a baseball team in Major League Baseball history that did not have a position player land on the injured list. I'll wait. So why not? Why not bring in a utility guy? Allow David Hensley to start the year in Sugar Land. Whenever you have the dude lands on the IL, David Hensley comes up here. It wouldn't bother me at all if Yuli Gurriel is that position player. We've heard reports that Yuli's seeking 2 years. Good luck getting that. We've heard reports that they want to that Yuli's looking for more plate appearances, which he could get that. Maybe Miami, maybe Minnesota.
Right? Yeah. I think the Astros want to make this work. I think they want Yuli on the team in the role that you described.
Sure.
I just think Yuli, as someone who's accomplished, he's a batting title champion, he's a multiple-time World Series champion, maybe sees himself as having, like you said, a longer-term contract, maybe more playing time, more money, and you're going to have to wait for him to come to that realization that maybe this is his best option before he would consider actually taking the job.
I don't think there's a lot of teams, and look, it's why Yuli Gurriel is still a free agent on January 24th. There's not a whole lot of teams that are beating down the door for a first baseman who hit .242 last year with a .647 OPS. It's just not going to happen. That's why he doesn't currently have a job. Could Miami sign him today? Sure. Could Minnesota sign him today? Sure. But John Heyman tweeted this out about an hour ago. He said, Yuli Gurriel's better hopes beyond the Marlins now might include the Astros and the Twins. He has likely supporters in both places, Dusty Crane in Houston, Correa in Minnesota. Astros already signed Abreu, but they could find some at-bats for Yuli. So that's what it's going to take. For Yuli Gurriel to be a Houston Astro, he's going to have to have the thought that you just said, B-Mac. He's going to have to come to a realization that at this stage of his career, coming off a season where he hit 242 and had a 647 OPS, if he's not going to get 500 plate appearances from a team, it makes sense for Yuli Gurriel to come back to the Houston Astros, be a utility player that plays mostly first base. Could he give you a little bit of third base? I don't know. He's going to give you nothing in the middle infield. He can't play outfield. He's pretty much a first base DH at this point. But because you have Yordan Alvarez and because you have Michael Brantley, a couple of guys who aren't known for their good health, right? They're not Cal Ripken. They're not Iron Men. And also the fact that they're both left-handed hitters. You're going to be looking for some spots where you want to sit Yordan Alvarez, give him a day off, where you're going to be looking to sit Brantley, give him a day off against left-handed pitching. That's a perfect time for Yuli Gurriel to get some DH work. Start him 25 games as the DH against left-handed pitching. Start him the 10 games that Jose Abreu needs off over the 162 games. 35 games started for Yuli Gurriel. I just drew up the plan. I'm cool with that. But Yuli Gurriel has to be cool with that.
Yeah, he does. And I do think there may be even more opportunity there. You mentioned he could play some third base. And let's not forget who the manager is. It stays off Dusty. Dusty's going to get...
And Dusty, I trust you. We're on great terms.
Yeah, you are on great terms. Maybe middle of last year, not as much.
We kicked it the other day.
Okay.
On Sunday. Oh, we hung out for upwards of 20 minutes.
Now... Are you guys soulmates like you are with Joe Burrow? I know you didn't ride an elevator with Dusty, and that's really how you...
Dusty's cooler than Joey B.
Okay.
Dusty's cooler than Joey B.
He's cooler than Joey B.
No doubt about it.
All right.
No doubt about it.
I mean, obviously the big conversation a lot during the middle of the year last season was how often Dusty was giving veterans the day off, and I do think...
Which was a complete overreaction.
Complete
overreaction by me and anybody else who was reacting overly to that.
You've done a 180 here. But I do think Yuli obviously should realize that. He knows that Dusty's going to give veterans days off. He's going to get at bats at DH and first base, maybe third base a few times a year. He could work himself into maybe 50 starts over the length of the season. And I think at his age, and like you said, he knows he only hit like 240 last year. I think that's got to be a role that he's willing to accept. Will he? Mm-hmm. It only takes one team out of 30 to go ahead and offer him multiple years and the starting day job at every day at first base or whatever. So it only takes one. But I do think the Houston Astros could offer him a role that makes a lot of sense for him.
Yeah, I'm a fan of it. And I know that I was very, very loud about Yuli Gurriel last year needing an upgrade at first base. And the Astros said, yeah, we do need an upgrade at first base, and signed Jose Abreu. They also traded for Trey Mancini, hoping he'd be an upgrade over Yuli. Just wasn't. Trey Mancini failed as a Houston Astro. But I welcome Yuli back, even though I was a very loud voice against Yuli Gurriel last season. Just shouldn't be a starter at this stage of his career, for a World Series contender.
And in your defense, obviously, I was one of these people. A lot of people, when you would make the argument against Yuli, especially after the postseason ended, mm-hmm. would bring up the fact, he hit 300 in every postseason series last year against Seattle, against the Yankees, and against the Phillies. But obviously, the other 29 teams have spoken. If the 300 batting average across the postseason was such a remarkable turnaround and a sign that he could still be the batting title type of player that he was the year before, then someone else would have signed him by now.
No doubt. He would have a job right now, and he doesn't. And the Astros also told you they felt they needed to upgrade at first base by signing Jose Abreu. But come back as a utility guy. We would love you for that, Yuli Gurriel, even maybe the loudest voice against you last year. There is a new name, B-Mac, that has emerged as a candidate for the Houston Astros. I think it was Nightingale that said this. Jose De Ortiz, who used to cover the Houston Astros. He's the one who tweeted this out. He said that it's down to Dana Brown and Brad Ausmus for the Houston Astros general manager job. Jose De Jesus Ortiz tweeted this out earlier this morning. Brad Ausmus, former Houston Astro, former backstop, good-looking man, should not be the general manager of the Houston Astros. Dana Brown, in order to leave Atlanta, is going to need the GM job. And quite honestly, the Astros need a nerd in that front office. Love Jeff Bagwell, love Dusty Baker and Dusty Itrusty, love Enos Cabell, love Reggie Jackson, love Jim Crane, the tribal chief, the head of the table of the Houston Astros, but they need a nerd in that office doing the GM work. scouring the stats of double-A players, scouring the stats of high school and collegiate prospects that are going to be draft eligible. And Dana Brown has a great history of doing this with Atlanta. Hadn't been there a lot, but is responsible for a couple of their big-time draft picks.
Sure.
Strider, also was it Grissom, too? Vaughn Grissom,
right.
I think he was very much responsible for in the outfielder. That
Michael
name is
Harris? Super.
Michael Harris.
Yeah.
Responsible for him as well. And dudes that they've already locked up long-term. Like, we know that the Astros are fine for the next 3 to 6 years with Yordan, with Tucker, with Fromber, with Javier, with McCullers in the fold, Bregman, Altuve, 2 more years. Did I mention Yordan? I think I did. Jeremy Pena, I did not. The Astros have a great foundation. But I talk about this all the time. The Astros' focus should be about being a sustained winner for the next decade to 2 decades. In order to extend this 3-6 year window that I think the Astros currently still have, they have to be able to replenish the farm that has, quite frankly, taken a hit because of a variety of different reasons. And this dude, Dana Brown, has a history of being able to do that. So if the Astros are serious about being a sustained winner for 10 years, 20 years, Dana Brown is the hire. But they can get both. Brad Ausmus should not be the general manager of the Houston Astros, but he can certainly be part of the front office. I think that the Astros should go get both of these guys. Dana Brown's going to need the GM job to entice him to leave Atlanta, hire a nerd for that position, and then bring in Brad Ausmus as whatever title you want to give him. He's best friends with Jeff Bagwell. Obviously, that he's tight with some of the other people in the Astros organization. Bring them both. Give Dana Brown the GM job. Give Brad Ausmus a high-ranking title. He's not doing anything right now anyways. Bring both guys into the fold.
I'm with you. I don't know. I won't speak for you or Joel, but I know I was a little bit concerned when we heard the clip from Bagwell, I guess it was about a month ago, talking about, you know, what role analytics would have in the decision-making going forward. And you mentioned it, this farm system, obviously once loaded, has been brought up to the major leagues, has been used in trades, and now with Hunter Brown coming up and probably being part of a six-man rotation, there aren't a lot of top-level prospects left in that organization. So I do hope that they make this decision to bring in, like you said, a nerd, someone that would trust analytics, use analytics, because past this next 2 or 3 years when Bregman and Altuve and a few others are going to be coming up on new contracts, you're going to need somebody like that, I think, to replenish the system and make the decisions necessary to keep this franchise going, you know, to a 7th, 8th, and 9th ALCS and World Series. So I do like Brad Ausmus. Always struck me as a very smart player. Obviously didn't really work out for him as a manager. I do think there's a role for him in this franchise, maybe kind of similar to what Bagwell has. But Dana Brown needs to be the de facto in-name actual GM making the main decisions.
No doubt about it. They need a nerd in that seat. And I'm not even saying that analytics needs to trump the old-school model, the old-school method. I don't think the Astros really want that to happen.
It just can't take a back seat.
It needs to be a heavy voice in the room.
Yeah, exactly.
It needs to have a heavy voice in the room. And if Brad Ausmus comes in, I think Brad Ausmus is a sharp cat, winning an Ivy League grad. Like, I think things of Brad Ausmus. But I don't think Brad Ausmus is going to bring up the voice of sabermetrics as much as it needs to. And quite frankly, Jim Crane has hired 2 general managers as the owner of the Houston Astros. Both have been uber nerds, and they have worked. Like, Jeff Luhnow was the pioneer of this golden era of Houston Astros baseball. He hired James Click, and he fired James Click, but he was the GM of a World Series winning team. I don't believe that Crane's going to go away from analytics. I think that Crane understands the value of analytics. I think at the end of the day, it's going to be Dana Brown. If it's not, if they hire Brad Ausmus, I'm going to have serious concerns about, you know, the 10 years after the 6-year window for the Houston Astros. So bring them both into the fold. Make sure you have a nerd in the room. And don't give them the biggest voice, but give them a voice. Also, one quick thing on Dana Brown, too. I don't think this prevents you from hiring a president of baseball operations. Like, David Stearns has been somebody that's mentioned, the former dude at Milwaukee. He says he's not going to leave. He's got another year left on his contract. Hiring Dana Brown as the GM isn't so big a name that you can't go get David Stearns as the head, the president of baseball operations in a year. Where, look, Dana Brown's your GM. Stearns oversees the whole organization.
Yeah, you're not bringing in a guy like for the NFL when teams are bringing in Bill Parcells. You're not bringing a personality and a name so big that he just naturally takes over every aspect of the organization. Dana Brown, while credentialed, is, like you said, not that sort of guy. And I don't think, as you mentioned, would preclude you from making a hire elsewhere.
Adrian sent us a Yuli Gurriel take that I'm not going to read today, but he made the list for Bad Take Boulevard on Thursday.
So Thursday
at 2, Adrian's take and text that just made the Bad Take Boulevard list. We'll debut it. But, yeah, Adrian, just a little forewarning. You made the list. All right, 713-780-ESPN. Cash it or trash it. We have two hot takes and two overreactions that BMAC and I have to get to. We try to sell it to each other. We try to sell it to you, the audience. Are you cashing them or are you trashing them? It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
ESPN 97.5.